True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. And if you'd like to skip the intro or move to any specific part of the podcast, please refer to the timestamps listed in the episode description. Thank you. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. It is March 1st, my birthday month, and it's actually always a horrible month. Let me just say, it's always a horrible month. March, I don't know what it is. For years, there's always been some like type of, this is going to sound like very selfish in a way, but I haven't been able to celebrate my birthday with my family for years, but like we intended to, but something always happens. Like for the past 3 years, someone's always been sick. There's always some drama. There's always something going on. So I never get to like have my original birthday plan, which is fine, whatever. I'm an adult. But I just noticed that always, for some reason, March seems very hectic. And this year, there's like this horrible Mercury retrograde going on right now. We just woke up and we're like at a war, apparently. At a war. We're in a war, apparently. I don't even know. I'm not going to speak about that, obviously. Yeah. But it just seems like a very chaotic month all the time. And it's probably the worst. It's just a tough time for weather too, because you feel like you should be at the end of winter and you're like, oh, spring is coming up, but it's still very wintry and disgusting. At this point, you're just sick of it.
Well, even here, because we have spoken in the past, so Australia's seasons begin on the 1st of the month. So 1st of March is the start of our fall, autumn. So today's the 2nd. So we're one day, and I just looked it up. It's still 82% humidity. I know things don't change straight away, but it's 82% humidity and it's like in the 90s a week. And I'm like, well, I'm glad that the season didn't get the memo that it's meant to change yet, because I'd prefer that than fall probably. But yeah.
Also, more things that suck about March is it's our daylight. Yours is April, right? It's ours, my daylight April, savings.
Yeah. I think they do ours.
That's annoying.
I don't really want to. I think it might be the first weekend in April they do it every year for us. It could even be Easter, because that is the first weekend in April. I know. Anyway, it's early April that they usually do it for us. I just don't understand why everyone is so different. Why you're seeing, and I know it goes on like ancient calendars and solstices and things like that, but why, like how can we have a different season? It's wild. I don't know. Everyone not the same? Everyone should be the same.
Yeah. Universal.
Yeah. Universal changes. Yeah.
Yeah. Our spring is allegedly, I know that it's a fact that our spring is Friday, March 20th, but I also say allegedly because it doesn't get warm here now until May. Like, you'll have a couple of nice days sprinkled in here and there, but it's still probably pretty chilly and kind of gross through April, because April it rains a lot. April showers bring May flowers. Is that a saying there? Because it's not the same for
you. No, it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be, because I, like, no, it's not the same here. I've heard the saying before, but I don't, I feel like it's not particularly rainy here. I don't know, maybe it is in fall, I don't know.
But that being said, we did have a shocking 50-degree day yesterday, which is like summer with the way things have been going. So we actually went to my sister's house because she lives on like a dead-end road. So we went and we walked with Jack up and down the road with them and my nephew. And it was Jack's like first real time outside. I brought him outside when he was like bored, because that was in August. But in August, it was way too hot to really bring him outside then either. So I'd bring him out like here and there when I could. And obviously, I bring him out here and there now, but this was his first, like, a proper walk outside for more than, for, like, an hour. And I was like, damn, this is the most fresh air you've got in your lungs. And I sent you a video. He was, like, so unimpressed by it. He was just, like, in his stroller, like, blah, like a little potato.
This is boring.
He did have a little scream fest, though, once we got to the end of the road, because there's, like, a lake down there, and he was looking at it. And there's a lot of mud, and my nephew was jumping in it, and Jack decided to show off his new screaming skills, which some people heard either, I think it was the bonus episode, one of the episodes I just edited, he had a scream going on to add some drama to the episode. But yeah, he had a little scream, so it was nice to get him outside. I can't wait for winter to end so I like can bring him outside. At least it's just like another thing to do to occupy him.
Yeah.
But yeah, what's going on with you? Anything exciting?
No. So we're going on this trip next month, which is now, well, now I can say next month. So it makes it feel real and exciting, even though it's only the 2nd of March. So it's still a while away. But yeah, so my daughter, I think I mentioned it, is dancing at Disneyland. So we've just started to knuckle down and get all the plans sorted for that. So that's exciting. But other than that, it's been pretty quiet, really, which is nice. I'm going to have a quiet weekend next weekend, just try and get everything sorted for the trip and the podcast while we're away. So pretty quiet, which is good.
That's good.
So one, I guess, thing to note is that now it's 1st of March in the US when we're recording. So it is 1 month since Nancy Guthrie went missing. I really thought last week, or like, I guess it's still your Sunday there. So this week for you, it would have been something would have happened. And it seemed a little bit promising where we had the car footage. Apparently the neighbor found this footage of 12 vehicles. It could have been vehicles coming back and forth, but 12 instances of cars driving down past Nancy's house between 12 a.m. and 6 a.m. I thought this might have been a good break, but it seems like nothing has happened. But also the neighbor said that the police never asked for this footage, which blew my mind, but then nothing should blow my mind in that case anymore, because
I know
who even knows. So yeah, just to note, 1 month, if you're listening to this episode at the time of recording, nothing has happened. I still have hope that things are happening behind the scenes, a bit like Moscow and all that. And all of a sudden out of the blue, there'll be an arrest, but it seems like things have scaled right back. The sheriff has said they're going to, I'm paraphrasing, but like, redeploy their resources, like basically reevaluate the resources that they're using, because now it's very, very, very highly unlikely that she is probably alive. So it'd be more of a recovery and an investigation at this point. I guess the sense of urgency is lessened because they're probably unlikely to find her alive, which is very sad.
Yeah, the reporters that have been out there, they have to be about ready to pack it up at this point, the ones that are still there.
I feel like, imagine like Brian Enton, for example, he's been there basically the whole time. Imagine if he calls it, because I think he lives like on the East Coast somewhere, if I'm making that up, but I feel like he lives far away from Arizona. Yeah. So imagine if he calls it and he goes back and all of a sudden.
That's literally what would happen.
Yeah. Like if I was him, I'd probably try and base myself there for the next month, even though like not just report on Nancy, but maybe try and be close, at least if something did happen, because all that work, and then imagine flying home and it breaks and you're not there for it. It would be a lot.
Yeah. I feel like possessive Brian Enton sometimes, because everyone's like talking about him now and I'm like, no, you guys don't know him, like we know him.
We've known him for all these years. I said at this point I feel like I do know him, because he's like on, I feel like when I say he's everywhere I go, I mean like on the internet.
Feel like we followed him when he was just a baby. Yeah. When he was just starting out with Gabby Petito, but I'm sure tons of people did. But I just remember that was where we started posting him like the most, and he just like blew up after that. Yeah. But I'm like, no. It's like when you like a band and then they suddenly blow up and you're like, no, I like them first.
I thought it was funny. Like I saw someone's TikTok the other day and they're like, we must protect Brian at all costs. And then like the comments are like, Brian for Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
And he wrote, like, he did actually comment on the TikTok. He's like, thanks for the support, guys, or something like that.
It's funny because we always post him. I think he's interacted with us maybe once. We're always like, we're tagging him, we're like, Brian.
I feel like it's Brian, a very one-sided here. Relationship, because we do like, we have quite a lot of reporters who will share their things and they often will interact with us. Like, there's Brian Schnee from Utah, I think he is, he always tags us and collaborates with us, like we love him.
And the other News Nation guy, Alex Cap, Capriello or whatever his name is, he'll interact with us and we tag him.
But like we keep tagging Brian and we're like, it's like very one-sided.
Yeah. We're not feeling the love back. He's busy.
I feel like Brian and I have a lot in common too. He's got golden retrievers. I've got Labradors. I feel like we could have a chat one day.
This episode is brought to you by IQBar, our exclusive snack, hydration, and coffee sponsor. IQ Bar Protein Bars, IQ Mix Hydration Mixes, and IQ Joe Mushroom Coffees are the delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel you need to win your day. The Ultimate Sampler Pack is a great way to try all of IQ Bar's products and flavors. You get 9 IQ Bars, 8 IQ Mix Sticks, and 4 IQ Joe Sticks. All IQ Bar products are clean label certified and entirely free from gluten, dairy, soy, GMOs, and artificial ingredients.
IQ Bar's plant protein bars are the smartest snack choice, with plenty of plant protein, tons of fiber, and no added sugar. So with over 20,000 five-star reviews and counting, more people than ever are fueling their busy lifestyles with IQ bars, brain and body boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. Their ultimate sample pack includes all three. My current favorite IQ bar flavor is salted caramel chip. It is absolutely delicious. I have been eating these bars now for probably 2 years. I just love them. Every single one I have, I'm like I go through stages where one is my favorite flavor and another one, but they are all absolutely delicious. And right now, IQ bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% off all IQ bar products, including the ultimate sampler pack plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text CRIME to 64,000. Text CRIME to 64,000. That's CRIME to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. All right. So before we get into the episode, we did have some new patrons this week. Jennifer, Maria, Shannon, Emily, Carly, Nikki, Megan, which I liked. I especially liked.
I saw that.
I was especially glad because like my instinct here, every Megan is a Megan, whereas I know you guys are Megan and all that. So Megan actually wrote in her username how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
So I was very happy about that. Roz, Delaney, Magika, I hope that's how you say it, Magika, Sarah and Olivia. So thank you very, very much. And we also don't have one listener of the week this week, but we've got quite a few. I'll read out a few of them. JF, Victoria, Caitlin and G. Bovell. Hopefully I'm saying that right. They all commented on our Folie à Deux episode. Great idea for an episode. Love this one. This is one of the first I deep dived on it. It was so baffling to me. Thanks for covering it. I think you girls are awesome. So some very, very kind, lovely comments this week. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for all the people who always like message and comment supporting me being a first time mom. I appreciate them all so much. They always make me feel a lot better because it's just crazy. It's just crazy. Every day is crazy. Okay. Today we are going to be talking about the topic of missing people who basically fake their own disappearances and were found alive. And it's just crazy because we always say, or I always say anyways, that people aren't doing this. They're not going out and starting a new life, but some people can and do.
Yeah.
Granted, these happened not like super long ago, but.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I actually feel like I know like it is a little while ago, but these are still recent enough like that it was, there's technology, there's CCTV, there's all these things happening. Whereas like if it happened in the 70s, like I know, for example, people used to go to the cemetery, mm-hmm. for example, and find a name of a baby who'd passed away and just assume that identity and it was way easier. Whereas I feel like now it's so much harder, but these are two cases that are, I think, recent enough that it's kind of mind-blowing that they were able to keep this charade up for one woman was 24 years, so a long time.
Well, I feel like with the Michelle Hunley one, I feel like that was them just being lazy because it seems like they just typed her name into a database at some point and were like, oh.
Yeah. Oh, what happened there?
Yeah.
But so we wanted to cover Michelle because it's one that's been in the news literally like every day for the last week or so. But our Patreon Kelsey also gave us a whole other list of people that have been missing and found alive. So the second case comes from Kelsey. So I wanted to say thank you to her for that.
Thank you.
The first case we're going to discuss is that of Michelle Hunley Smith. She was 38 years old when she went missing from North Carolina on December 9th of 2001. Just the other day, February 20th of 2026, authorities made a statement that Michelle had been found alive and well and that she didn't want any contact with her family.
Rude.
For nearly a quarter century, Michelle Hunley Smith's name sat in a missing persons database. After her discovery over the weekend, the case has taken another turn. A DWI charge weeks before she disappeared.
The Rockingham County District Attorney told us she won't pursue charges related to Michelle Hunley Smith's 2001 disappearance, saying there's a lack of evidence after reviewing the case with detectives. Smith was 38 when she left her Rockingham County home in December and never returned. A new twist in this strange story, court records show Smith was charged with a DWI a month before she disappeared and obviously didn't show up for court after she disappeared. The district attorney says that charge remains active, and the sheriff's office says deputies plan to serve that warrant. Last week, the Rockingham County Sheriff's Office found her alive. The sheriff told us her information was recently entered into an online database somewhere else in North Carolina, which then alerted detectives to her whereabouts.
Now, investigators say Smith told them she left because of an ongoing domestic dispute. But Sheriff Sam Page told us his office has no records related to domestic issues prior to Smith's disappearance. As we've reported, Smith asked investigators to keep her location a secret. She left behind a husband and three kids.
She was living in North Carolina at the time in 2001. Some reports say she was living in Stoneville. Others say Eden. I think Stoneville may be her actual home address, but they're both very close to each other anyways, I believe. So if you, either one could be correct. She lived with her husband and her three children. Her oldest daughter was 19 at the time. Her second daughter is Amanda. Amanda was 14 at the time. We have named her in this because she's been very vocal in the search for her mother. She's been on podcasts. She ran a Facebook page for her. The other two, we do know their names. I'm not going to say them, but they basically haven't been as public with, you know, their identities, and that's fine. So Amanda was 14 and she also had a 7-year-old son. I did try to find the name of Michelle's husband. He has never really been named publicly, so we aren't going to name him either. Amanda would later say that her parents' marriage was tumultuous. Both Michelle and her husband struggled with alcohol abuse and they often fought. Both of them were known to have cheated on each other. Despite all of this, there were no official records of any domestic issues on file with the authorities. So it seems like they kept their issues kind of in-house. There was no court records or anything like that regarding any domestic abuse. On the night of Sunday, December 9th, 2001, Michelle told Amanda that she was going to go Christmas shopping at a Kmart in Martinsville, Virginia. This was around a 30-minute drive from their house. Amanda said that she wanted to go with her mother, but Michelle said no as she was planning to buy her Christmas gift. So that seems like a pretty plausible excuse. You don't want your child to come Christmas gift shopping with you.
In hindsight, what a fucking shitty excuse too, because now that daughter is always going to be like, wow, if only she wasn't going out to buy me Christmas presents.
Yeah. So I agree. There is an episode of the Vanished podcast from 2018 where Amanda spoke a lot about this. I've listened to it a few times in the last week just because I found it so unbelievable now to know. Because at the time, obviously, 2018, they had no idea what had happened to their mother. So it was so interesting to hear what they were thinking at the time versus now what we know actually happened. Amanda has said things along the lines of it wasn't unusual for her mother to go to that Kmart or to that area to go shopping. It wasn't unusual for her to go shopping at nighttime. So these things kind of weren't out of the ordinary. It didn't raise any red flags. Mm-hmm. So Michelle left the home in her green 1995 Pontiac Transport van with the license plate Rock and On, R-O-K-N-On. She was never seen again. So Amanda did speak about how Michelle then missed the family Christmas in 2001. She said, I'll never forget that first Christmas without her. We didn't even care about presents or anything. Our mum was gone. Nothing was ever the same after that. She also said that she and her mother were best friends and that Michelle was a really good mother. We had a very special bond. So on December 31st of 2001, Michelle's husband reported her missing. So this was 22 days after she was last seen. I agree, this kind of is a red flag for me. I would have been like, why did you wait so long? Based on the Vanished episode, it does seem like they did think there was a chance Michelle had taken off voluntarily. So maybe they thought she would come back. Maybe they were waiting, but it does seem like a long time. Yeah. The authorities who were involved in the search for her included the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So this information about the case is from an archived version of the Charlie Project, and it goes on to kind of give you a little bit more information about her disappearance. It says, Amanda stated her father, after Michelle disappeared, assumed she'd simply left. He claimed she'd removed an unspecified amount of money from their bank account before leaving the house that night. However, Michelle's other relatives never believed she would have left on her own as she was close to her own mother and they don't think she would have abandoned her or her three children. Michelle routinely carried a purse containing her wallet, her own social security card, and the cards of her children. About 5 years after Michelle went missing, someone in Cumberland, Maryland used her daughter's social security number. This person has not been identified and it's not clear whether this has any relationship with Michelle's case. So we'll get into that a little bit more, but that was just the general information. That was basically all we knew about the disappearance for most of the time. Mm-hmm. In 2018, Amanda made this post on social media begging for information. She said, Mama, this is Amanda. If you see this, please know I'm not mad at you and I just want to know that you're safe. In fact, to be honest, I'd rather find out that you had just left and that you are still alive. Amanda has said that she could never see her mother just up and leaving and not contacting the family. Amanda also had cancer at one point, and she said that she wanted to find out what happened to Michelle in case the worst happened to her. Amanda spoke to Dateline about what her father thought about Michelle's disappearance. She said he believed she just took off and left him and us that night. So as I mentioned, The Vanished did an episode on Michelle in 2018. I went through and listened again, and I pulled out the kind of most interesting points from that. I'll link the episode on the blog if you want to listen to it too. Amanda was the interviewee for the episode, so they spoke a lot to her, and this was done 17 years after Michelle disappeared. So Amanda said that, as we mentioned, Michelle struggled with alcohol abuse. After she disappeared, Amanda told her father about the drinking, and she showed him kind of sounded like a shed-like structure in the yard, and it was filled with empty rum bottles that Michelle had stashed there. Michelle had been fired from her job at a veterinary practice for drinking at work. Amanda said her parents were unhappy in their marriage and that they slept apart. She also said that her older sister's birthday was the 18th of December, and she struggled to believe that her mother would have left before that and before Christmas voluntarily. In the episode, she talks about how Michelle had lost her license at the time that she disappeared. She says something like Michelle was driving one of her father's friends home and the guy was drunk, and she crossed lines and she lost her license because of that. She was due to appear in court because of that traffic violation, and Amanda thought she may reappear once the statute of limitations on that charge was up. As of the episode in 2018, there had not been a single sighting of Michelle or her van, which her van seems like, especially it had the distinctive number plate, so you would think that someone would have seen it if it was still on the road somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. Not.
One theory they discussed in the episode was that Michelle's car left the road and crashed somewhere out of sight, but they said the night that she disappeared was clear. There was no rain, there was no snow. And there was also apparently no waterways on the route that she would have taken to the store. So like a lot of people often theorize in long-term missing persons cases where there is the car that is also missing, that they've gone into the water and that's why they're not found. But apparently that was quite unlikely in this case.
Yeah.
Amanda also discussed the possibility that Michelle may have been in some type of car accident and may have been suffering from amnesia, didn't know who she was, wasn't able to come home. When Michelle disappeared, as we mentioned, she had both her own and her children's social security cards with her. 5 years after she vanished, a letter arrived at her original home from Cumberland in Maryland, and that letter was addressed to Michelle, but it stated that Amanda's social security number had been used by an ambulance to get an ambulance. Amanda said she tried to get more information about this, but she was unable to. She said that she was unable to visit Cumberland to get more information. That was around a 5.5-hour drive from where she lived. So I find this very interesting. Like, I feel like this could have been a big hint in the case, but it just seems like they weren't able for whatever information to get any reason to get any information. Amanda also theorized in the episode that Michelle had maybe passed away following a fight with her husband, like an accidental death, and that her body had been covered up. Amanda does speak about how there was this area in the woods near her house where she wasn't allowed to go. So I guess she spoke a lot about the suspicion that her dad and Michelle's husband was placed under after her disappearance. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Michelle's husband got a new partner in July 2002, which was around 7 months after she disappeared.
Amanda said, pretty fast.
Yeah, I agree.
Even though I know like they were like tumultuous, but I feel bad for the kids. Like their mom's missing. 7 months later, dad's already got a new girlfriend. I'd be like, hello?
Yeah. So Amanda said he refused to speak about Michelle. The only thing he really did say over the years was at one point that she had left a note behind. Amanda said she never saw the note. It's unclear if it existed. And she kind of indicates that her father gave different stories about this note. So it wasn't very clear if it actually ever existed or not. Amanda also said that Michelle's husband alleged early on that Michelle was siphoning money from their accounts, small amounts so that he wouldn't notice. Basically, Amanda says that she would do the banking for the family and the business, so she would go and add a little bit more onto whatever transaction she was meant to do. So she could have had this kind of stockpile of cash. Yeah. And that would have left her with enough money to leave with, apparently. So the Rockingham County Sheriff's Office worked on the case for more than 2 decades with no result. The office posted online asking for information in both 2020 and 21, and they announced a cash reward for information. So over the years, Amanda created a Facebook page called Bring Michelle Hundley Smith Home. This is one post I pulled. It was from October last year when it was Michelle's birthday. She wrote, "Happy birthday to my mother. Wherever you may be, I wish I had answers, and I still hold hope that one day I will receive them. I love you, Mama. No matter what happened, I miss you so deeply it hurts my soul. There are just some things that only a mother can fix." So that was October last year, so very, very soon before we're going to find out exactly what happened.
It's so, like, horrible. Just
And even for Amanda to have suffered cancer, I think she may have recovered because that was 2018. I don't know what her health status is, but she was very public with all this information. I'm thinking Michelle probably saw it or would have been aware of it, maybe. I don't know. But just still have no contact after all of this is pretty
wild. Think, like, yeah, I mean, not to, like, go off the rails already, but to leave, like, your children like that, I think you have to be a total piece of garbage.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk more about it at the end because I have a bit to say too. So Michelle's own mother passed away in 2025. As we mentioned, apparently Michelle and her mother had been very close, and Michelle's mother passed away without knowing what happened to her daughter. So on February 19th, 2026, detectives at the Rockingham County Sheriff's Office received information about Michelle's whereabouts. Detectives followed up and spoke to Michelle. She is now in her 60s, and Michelle told authorities that she doesn't want to be in contact with her family and she doesn't want her location disclosed to them. So the sheriff released this statement. So from what I've gathered is someone sent in some type of tip on February 19th. We don't know what the tip is, who sent it in, but they were able to investigate and just speak the following day with Michelle. So it seems like she was hiding in plain sight this whole entire time.
Yeah.
They say on February 20th, detectives made contact with Michelle Hunley Smith at an undisclosed location within North Carolina, alive and well. At her request, her current whereabouts will remain undisclosed. Her family has been notified that she has been located and informed of this request as well. So she's still in the same state. She didn't even, if she left the state, she was back. So she's still in the same state as where she left from.
I'd be so annoyed too, because I'd be like, you got caught, you got found out, and you're still going to be like, no, don't tell my family. Like,
yeah.
Own up to your mistakes at this point.
So Michelle told authorities that she had left, quote, due to ongoing domestic issues. She didn't elaborate on what that meant. This is an excerpt I found from WFMY News about how she was found and the whole, I guess, you know, chaos surrounding it. It says, 24 years later, Sheriff Page said Michelle's information was recently entered into an online database, which then alerted detectives to her whereabouts. So that goes against the tip thing, but I guess it could have also been maybe someone else, like, found it on this online database. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know any more information about the specifics of how she was found.
That's why I was like, if it was just that, it just seems like, why didn't they do that sooner?
Yeah. Like, I just feel like it can't be that hard to run a yearly check, like, on a name or a social security number or some type of other identifier. Why aren't they doing, like, there should be even just some automatic process that you can set it up and do that. I don't know. It's crazy to me. Court records show Michelle had a DWI charge in November 2001. So this is what Amanda was referring to where she crossed the line. So Amanda didn't call it a DWI in the episode, but apparently that's what it was, which was a month before her disappearance, which led to an arrest order for failure to appear in late December 2001. Rockingham County District Attorney confirmed the underlying DWI charge remains outstanding. According to the sheriff, the DA won't pursue any charges against Michelle related to her disappearance after consulting with detectives on the case. The DA confirmed that there is not enough evidence to bring charges of abandonment against Michelle. However, the DA said she believes Michelle should be served with the outstanding DWI warrant, and the sheriff's office plans to serve the outstanding warrant against her. So Amanda in the Vanished episode spoke about the statute of limitations in this case, and that, you know, once that was up, they thought the mum might reappear. But I found this information about that, and we'll get into a little bit more too, because in the last few days there's been even more information come up about that. It says this news agency clarified with the DA's office that Michelle has an outstanding charge and can be served for this at any time by any law enforcement agency. So after Michelle was found, Amanda wrote on the Facebook page for her mother, "The personal details are not going to be dived into right now, but I will say my mother chose her new life and we know she is alive. And for now, that is enough. I can't really think straight right now." Michelle's cousin Barbara also spoke to the media. She said, "I kind of want to go outside and scream, she's alive, she's alive. My biggest question is to her, what happened all those years ago in December? What made you leave? What happened?" She went on to say, "I understand and respect that she doesn't want any of us to contact her. I'm not angry. The biggest answer I had today was that she's alive and nothing else matters right at this moment." Amanda has spoken about the obviously mixed emotions that she would be feeling after she found out her mother was alive. She said, "I am ecstatic. I'm pissed. I'm heartbroken. I'm all over the map. Will I have a relationship once more with my mum? Honestly, I can't answer that because I don't even know." She said, "Everything I've been through in life, I can absolutely understand taking off and leaving. I'm not saying that she gets off scot-free without accountability or responsibility because she absolutely needs to do that. What I am saying is that I am a runner as well. And while this isn't something to be proud of, it's all part of being human." Amanda also spoke about the accusations that her father had faced over the years. You know, we always say, we always, you know, make a little joke, it's always the husband. And I feel like in this case, mm-hmm. it was probably pretty plausible that it may have been. They were having a bad yeah. time in their marriage. He gave some kind of strange stories, like Michelle had apparently stolen money. He made up this story or gave this varying story about the note. So I feel like it did seem a little bit suspicious, and I'm not surprised that he was
kind of And he had a reporter missing for so long.
Yeah, 20, though, like, over 3 weeks. In hindsight,
it makes Absolutely. Sense, I guess, but...
But I guess it shows you that sometimes, you know.
You never know.
You never know. So Amanda said that her father is a great man who faced accusations for more than 2 decades. She said, "Even before social media was big, when we lived in a small town, there were many people acting as if they just knew he was involved. Well, he wasn't." So I can't even imagine. He must be feeling such relief as well, probably.
I would hate this woman if I was him.
Yeah.
Absolutely hate. Because not only did she just up and leave, abandon you and the children. I mean, I know that they had a bad relationship at that point, but just like abandoning your children, your family, they're probably really sad. He had to deal with all the fallout from that. And then not only that, the whole town and the internet and everyone's probably blaming him for it.
Yeah. And it's a tiny little town. Like, I looked up where they live. It's a very small kind of rural area. Like, they had acres of land around their house. Like, where I feel like it would be somewhere where everyone knows who you are. So there'd be no, it's not like a city where you can kind of blend in and be anonymous. Everyone would have known what was going on. They would have all known their apparent business at the time.
Yeah.
So on Monday, February 23rd of 2026, Michelle was taken into custody. This information is from KPLC TV. It says, "Michelle was arrested after the Rockingham County Sheriff's Office asked the Robeson County Sheriff's Department to take her into custody on an outstanding warrant for failure to appear. This all stems from her DWI charge. Michelle posted a $2,000 bond, and she is scheduled to appear in court again on March 26th. So they did release a mugshot of Michelle. I personally wouldn't have been able to pick it's the same person. Obviously, it's been 24 years. Everyone looks different after 24 years. Someone said her nose looks the same. Maybe, I don't know. I just feel like she just looks like an older woman now. I would have definitely never been able to pick it was the same person.
Well, especially if she still had like a drinking problem, yeah. that could also make you look a little rougher.
The New York Post released an article on her, and I feel like they absolutely roasted Michelle. This is a quote from them. It says, "Her mugshot shows her now haggard and teary-eyed after 24 years on the run from her family and the law. Her arrest report suggests she's living in a trailer park in one of the poorest corners of the state." But this is interesting. "About 2 hours from the family home that she abandoned." So she left her life to essentially live a life of poverty in a trailer park, but still only 2 hours away from where her family house is. That's crazy. It's
crazy. Crazy.
So there is an article just from today that I've picked out some information from, because it does give some information about how Michelle can still be charged even though it's been so long since this DWI. Local attorney Jason Keith said that arrest warrants do not expire. He said there's an active arrest warrant that's been issued by a judge. The sheriff has to serve it, whether it's 24 years, 50 years, or 100 years, because a person cannot evade the criminal prosecution laws in their jurisdiction. Arrest warrants are forever in essence until they're served. He did go on to say that if the case moves forward, it's up to the district attorney, and that will depend on what evidence still exists after more than 2 decades. He said, "What evidence is still going to exist 24 years later in a criminal prosecution? And will the prosecutor's office elect to try and prosecute a case 24 years later, understanding that pretty much all of the actors, evidence, witnesses involved will either have forgotten or possibly be no longer available because they have moved or passed away?" According to the police in North Carolina, the charges in 2001 were written up as citations, meaning there is no full incident report on file. The officer who did charge Michelle in 2009 has retired. Sorry, the officer who did charge Michelle retired in 2009, but he will likely be called to testify if the case proceeds. I wonder if they are just proceeding with all this. I know they're saying the warrant has to be served. I'll be shocked if the DWI thing does proceed anymore? Like, are they really going to bother with the resources for something that happened 23 years ago? I one thing that came out of this for me is that her family now know where she lived because her address is in court records. So even though she's like, I don't want them to know, I don't want to have any contact with them, they do now know. So
I feel like it's all kind of just like a roundabout punishment.
Yeah. So I will be shocked if her actual criminal thing proceeds. I don't even know. I have so many thoughts about this. Like, I made a post on the Facebook page and there were people with varying opinions. Someone wrote something along the lines of, men do this all the time. And you know what? I'm absolutely not advocating for anyone to stay in an abusive or a toxic relationship. It sounds like their marriage was very toxic. We don't know if it was abusive, but they were both very unhappy. So I agree she shouldn't have stayed in the relationship if she didn't want to, but she could have also left and told the children or told the husband, even if she didn't want to be in the family anymore and wanted to have no contact, but they didn't have to wonder for 24 years if she was alive.
Yeah, I agree.
And for him to live under that, you know, shadow of the accusations, I just feel like there was a more kind and caring way she could have gone about this. Maybe she felt it would be better. Like, we don't know. Maybe she has some type of mental illness and she thought it would be better for everyone if she took off. I don't know. But I just feel like they were very public over the years. There was multiple articles, a Facebook page, a podcast episode about her. She had to surely have known that they were still looking for her and still wanted to know. And even despite one of her kids being sick with cancer, her own mother passing away, she never came forward. I just feel like that is a pretty disgusting move. Yeah.
I agree. Like, it is a good point to make about, could there have been domestic violence? Maybe. But then it's even like, you know what, go hide away for however long, but not 24 years. Like, after a month when you're like away and safe, be like, hey, I'm actually okay. I'm here. I just had to get away to your kids. Yeah. Like, I could excuse it maybe more if there wasn't kids involved, but like, that's so damaging to them. Imagine going your whole life thinking your mom is probably dead, wondering what happened to her. She went out getting Christmas presents for you, like such a good mom, and then she never came back. And then you find out, actually, she just didn't fucking like you at all, apparently, and wanted to leave.
In the Vanished episode, I did find it quite interesting because they make a point of speaking about how they refer to it as when Michelle left. So I feel like at the start they did think she'd probably left, but then as time went on and there was absolutely no sign of her, they became maybe a bit worried that something else had happened. Amanda did speak about how her younger brother absolutely hated her mother because he felt that she had left, which in the end turned out to be true. So I just, yeah, I feel horrible for the kids. I just think that, you know, she could have left, and even if she didn't want to have anything to do with the family, I understand things get too much sometimes, but she could have left and told them she was going and that she was all right and that was it and be done with them all rather than just leaving them in limbo for 24 years.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And she'll probably never – I wonder if she will talk to them again. Yeah. I feel like she won't, or she's going to avoid it as much as she can and will probably never – explain herself is the vibe I get.
I wonder if she'll talk to the media. She hasn't as of the time of recording. I would be
she
interested
could be desperate for money.
Yeah, I would be interested to hear her story.
Same, unfortunately.
Yeah, and like I don't want anyone to think I'm saying she shouldn't have left. If she was unhappy in her marriage and there was abuse, and like, you know, anyone can leave a relationship for any time. She doesn't need to make an excuse for that. But I just feel like the way that she treated her children especially is horrible.
Yeah, like you can leave your relationship and even leave your family if you really want, but don't like fake your death basically. Not just fake your death, but don't like fake that you're just totally gone.
And she very clearly made a plan. She didn't, like Amanda said that she would often go shopping with her mom, and her mom specifically said no that night, that she couldn't come. And I know she gave the reason about buying Christmas presents, which seems plausible, but if she did take the money, she'd obviously been planning this for a while. This wasn't just a spur of the moment thing after, say, a massive fight with her husband. She'd been planning this for probably months. So very, very sad for the kids. I'm glad that they know now and they can stop wondering, but then also dealing with the other emotions that come with it would be a lot for them.
Yeah, at this point, it's like, were they better off just never knowing that that was the truth?
Yeah, what's more hurtful, knowing that she did it and now still doesn't want contact with you, or never knowing?
Yeah. All right, so the second case we're going to talk about today is of Colorado attorney Royal Scoop Daniel III. We're just going to refer to him as Scoop. That's his nickname.
Yeah.
So Scoop disappeared in April 2007 and was found alive in 2011. So we'll get straight into his story without too many spoilers. So we'll start some background on him. Scoop was born in 1945 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He graduated from Yale and got his law degree from the University of Virginia. He practiced for many years in Washington, D.C. During this time, he traveled frequently to Brazil and became fluent in Portuguese. One of his legal specialties was international Brazilian commerce. Sounds very niche.
Yeah, very niche.
Scoop was married at one point and he had 8 children with his wife. I couldn't even imagine having 8 children.
I guess this is another case too where there's a whole bunch of children involved.
Yeah. He eventually founded the Daniel Law Firm with a partner in 1990. And in 1994, Scoop divorced his wife. He moved the law firm from Washington, D.C. and settled in Breckenridge, Colorado. While in Breckenridge, he worked as a real estate attorney and was an active member of the local community. He was said to have worked pro bono for West African immigrants in the community and helped them apply for their green cards. It's nice.
He also, like, another very niche interest. He's a man of very varied interests.
Yeah. Scoop was also an active member of his church, Father Dyer Methodist Church. He served on the church committee and also helped with administration. He played guitar in the church band and sang in the choir. He also started a new relationship in Breckenridge with a woman named Jennifer Rathbun. So on Thursday, April 26, 2007, Scoop attended a community fundraiser. He spoke to friends and nobody mentioned any erratic behavior on his behalf. Everything had seemed fine. He purchased several items during a fundraising auction. And the following day, Friday, April 27, 2007, a coworker of Scoop's arrived at the Daniel Law Firm at 8:30 a.m. This firm was located at 130 Ski Hill Road in Breckenridge. The employee found coffee brewing and Scoop's dog was also in the office. In Scoop's office sat an empty cereal bowl, a pen, and a pair of broken sunglasses were on the floor. It appeared as if Scoop had come to work that morning but had left. During the day, he missed 2 scheduled appointments, and by 3 p.m., when there was no sign of him, his coworkers filed a missing person report with the Breckenridge Police Department. At 7:48 p.m. on that day, a 911 call was made from Scoop's cell phone. A dispatcher answered, and there was silence on the line. The call lasted for about 9 seconds, and the location of the phone pinged a tower near his law firm office. When police searched Scoop's apartment, they found his Kawasaki motorcycle, his laptop, and his passport were missing. As mentioned, his dog Ben was in the office, and his car was parked in front of the office. Authorities reviewed CCTV and found that Scoop was seen at 5:35 a.m. arriving at the law firm, but he was not seen leaving the premises. Police interviewed Scoop's girlfriend, Jennifer. She told them that he dropped her off at home at 5:30 a.m. on April 27th. He gave her a key to his house, which she thought was strange as he never locked the home. He also gave her his jogging suit and Sorel boots and told her that he would not need them for a while, which is like, were they the same size? You know? Jennifer said that Scoop was in extreme credit card debt and that she had tried to help by opening a line of credit for him at the bank where she worked. Scoop had been rejected because of his high debt levels and tax liens. Just what you want in a boyfriend.
Mm.
It was also determined that on the morning of April 27th, Scoop called the woman who had run the charity auction the previous night. He gave her a Visa card number to pay for the auction items that he purchased. But when she ran the card, later, it was declined. Of course.
Mm.
Scoop's assistant, Sarah Bailey, told authorities that on the day he disappeared, she found her paycheck in an envelope on her desk. She said this was strange as he normally would give her a paycheck just minutes before 5 p.m. every payday. At least he thought of her, I guess.
Yeah, at least he didn't leave a hanging. But
yeah. Sarah also said that she found a letter once that indicated Scoop was behind on child support. She also found a 2005 letter of discipline from the Colorado Supreme Court, which oversees licensed lawyers. I wonder how much child support you have for 8 kids.
Yeah. And even I tried to find more information about the letter, but they basically said that the contents are confidential, that they don't release it. It seems like it was just probably a general letter, maybe letting him know that he was under investigation or whatever. There's no actual details about what they were disciplining him about.
So after Scoop disappeared, 7 people contacted authorities saying that he had been holding escrow money for them. 4 of them said that he held more than $500,000 of their money. In May 2007, an arrest warrant was issued for Scoop on suspicion of Class 3 felony theft. The State Attorney Regulation Council said it's believed that Scoop may have withdrawn up to $1 million in his client's funds before disappearing. And friends say that he may have traveled to Brazil. Investigators contacted the U.S. Passport Agency, which told them that Scoop had renewed his passport in 2006, giving the reason for renewal as travel in late April 2007. The affidavit revealed that Scoop had been transferring clients' money without their knowledge to 10 bank accounts that he controlled. This was illegal for attorneys to do, obviously. This information is from the Denver Post. It says, one client, Eugene Gregory of Franktown, who owned an excavating company in Breckenridge, told investigators that Daniel spent $250,000 that he gave him as escrow money for a 1031 real estate exchange in 2006. In 1031 exchanges, a real estate owner may trade one property for another and transfer any tax liability to the second property. When confronted by Gregory, Daniel said he had used the money to repay other 1031 clients, then admitted that he was about $300,000 in debt. Eventually, Daniel repaid most of the $250,000, Gregory said. In an email to authorities, Gregory wrote, Scoop admitted a year ago that he was in debt and he was using one person's 1031 money to close the last 1031 and that the funds were no longer there. Seems like a mess. It literally seems like the worst person to handle money.
I know, borrowing money from everyone else to pay off these other debts. It's, very chaotic.
Never works out at the end. According to the affidavit, Scoop had tried to borrow money in 2000. He wrote on his loan application that he had been representing Trans-Brazil Airlines. The airline had suffered a major downturn in business in 1997 and had canceled the majority of international flights on their schedule. He wrote in the application, as a result, our income from that client, which was about 60% of a $250,000 per year practice, dropped to nothing. This has caused us to retool the practice over the last 2 years. On May 25, 2007, Scoop was suspended from practicing law in Colorado. On December 7, 2011, almost 5 years after he vanished, he was found alive in San Diego. He was arrested as he had attempted to cross into California from Mexico using his real passport, and this triggered the warrant that was out for him, so... I don't know what he was doing. I guess maybe he didn't know there was a warrant out for him.
Well, he goes on to say he didn't know he was a wanted man. But, like, would you really think that if you had stolen hundreds of thousands of dollars and hadn't had contact
with anyone for 5 years,
people weren't going to be looking for you?
Yeah. Scoop was held in San Diego Central Jail on a $175,000 bond. He was charged with 8 counts of felony theft and 5 counts of commercial bribery. Scoop would say that he was in dire financial trouble in 2007, and he was barely able to keep his business afloat. He said that he considered taking his own life, and that was his plan on the day that he disappeared. He said he decided to kill himself by driving off a mountain on Hoosier Pass in Colorado. He said that he took his passport so that his body could be identified, and he said that he called 911 for help, but then changed his mind and hung up the phone. He then got on a bus to Frisco, Texas, before traveling to southern Mexico.
Yeah, so I did wonder about this. How come, like, if they've contacted the passport office, how come they didn't look and see what entries, transactions?
Yeah, like, look it up,
But then I guess, too, and this is 2000 and, 2006?
Yeah.
Maybe he entered at a place that was a bit more lax. Like, I know, and I don't think it's quite the same these days, but I know previously in the past, people always said it was a lot easier to enter Mexico than it was to come back without a passport. So maybe he somehow got in without using the passport. Maybe it just slipped through because he didn't have this warrant out yet. But then you would just also think if he did use the passport, which we don't know if he did, but if he did, wouldn't that be like the first place you would look, especially as they knew that he had taken the passport was missing. So probably he had taken it with him.
Yeah, it just seems like it slipped through the cracks somehow. Yeah. I don't know.
It reminds me of the Michelle thing. Like, if she just popped up in some random database, how come after 24 years? Like, surely this
maybe it is easier to start a new life than we thought.
Well, yeah, and I guess too, Mexico is, where as like a stereotypical place where people flee because it's sometimes easier to get in there and to remain hidden, maybe.
Yeah. He said, I wanted to go somewhere warm and kill myself where no one would know me. He also spoke about leaving his dog in the office. He said, I knew he'd be okay. I wasn't going to survive past noon. When Scoop got to Mexico, he said he climbed over the railing of an 11th floor balcony and intended to jump. He said a woman from an adjoining room came out and kept him from letting go and falling. I want to hear from this woman. Like, is that true? It sounds very Titanic, dramatic.
Surely, yeah, I don't know. Surely, like, what did the hotel do? Did they not find out who this man was? He obviously needed psychiatric help. I feel like that isn't made up. I feel like that part is probably made up.
Me too. Scooped lived in Acapulco, Mexico for the next 4 years. He said that he was unaware there was an arrest warrant out for him. He said he worked as a freelance writer and did translation work. He earned about $600 a month. He said that was enough money to keep me alive. He testified that he led a hermit's life in Mexico with only one friend, an elderly woman in the last stages of terminal illness. Again, with like the dramatics, I guess. In 2010, Scoop became eligible to collect Social Security payments when he turned 65. This information is from the disappearedblog.com. It says, the Social Security Administration did not suspend his payments as he was not wanted for escape or flight from justice warrants.
So I have a lot of questions about this too. It sounds to me like he was eligible for the payments and the payments went to his account. So did they not see where, like, if this account was being accessed? It sounds like that's what he used to live off.
Well, it says that
off.
He has checks, but because later it says he was, like, trying to, like, cash his checks or something. But then I'm like, how is he getting the checks?
I don't know. I have a lot of questions about that. Like, maybe it's just a general info that maybe the money was accumulating in his account. Maybe that's part of why he had to come back. I don't know. I have a lot of questions about it, but I just feel like that's another weird part to the story.
Yeah, me too. Like, there's just like not enough information out there because it doesn't really totally make sense. Scoop said that after his friend passed away, he decided to return to the U.S. and do the right thing. He said, that's when I got the courage to face the things that needed to be faced.
But this is also despite him saying he didn't know there was an arrest warrant out for him. I guess he knew he'd stolen all the money, but I don't know.
He's just trying to make himself look like a better person.
Yeah.
Authorities had doubts about his story, and this info comes from summitdaily.com. It says, but prosecutors here painted a different picture, saying Scoop spent his years in Mexico drinking beer on the beach on Sundays and returned to the U.S. to open an American bank account that would save him money when depositing Social Security checks. So, like, that's what I mean. Like, how was he getting the checks?
Yeah.
The district attorney played a recording of Daniel's original statement after his arrest stating the same. In the recording, Daniel stated, if he'd known there was a warrant out for his arrest, he likely wouldn't have returned to the U.S. So not the good guy that he's portraying.
He might have gotten a bit cocky too. Like, he might have been like, now it's been nearly 5 years. Surely no one's looking for me anymore. It's safe. I don't know. It could have been a bunch of reasons, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in April 2012, Scoop took a plea deal and pleaded guilty to two charges of felony theft. He was sentenced to 12 years in state prison and was ordered to pay $462,000 in restitution to his victims. Under the agreement, Scoop was facing a maximum of 16 years behind bars. He told the judge he didn't know how to show how sorry he was. He said, I don't know how to be more remorseful. I didn't think of myself as a thief. I'm like, what? You stole a lot of money.
Yeah, I feel like he's probably trying to make excuses and saying he just got so far in over his head. His intentions weren't bad. He just had no other way to get out of it, apparently.
Yeah. Some of Scoop's victims spoke in court during his sentencing. One victim said, I want the right thing for us as victims to at least feel we have come out with something. We may never see our money, but at least let us know that he can never do this to another human being. Another victim named Craig Campbell said, I was in 6 months of therapy and had to take antidepressants. And that was after he had lost about $175,000 when Scoop disappeared. Dr. Mark Newkirk said that his total financial loss was upwards of $500,000. And I like how, like, in Scoop's like, I didn't think of myself as a thief. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Dr. Mark Newkirk said, this affected our marriage greatly. We were separated for 6 months and almost got divorced thanks to this. So as of February 2026, Scoop does not show on the Colorado Department of Corrections website as an inmate. If he started his sentence in 2012, he was sentenced to 12 years. He would have been out by 2024 at the latest. And there's no information online about his current whereabouts or what he's up to.
Yeah, I would love to know what he is up to. He's up, like, I've Googled, I tried to find, there's nothing really out there.
I went back to Mexico. Kind of just,
probably. Now he's probably set up his Social Security payments correctly and he's going to live on the beach in Mexico.
Yeah. I feel like you shouldn't get Social Security payments anymore. Yeah. I don't know how it works.
I don't know how it works either if you're convicted. I don't know. But you may be familiar with this case because there was a disappeared episode for him called Royal Secrets. So if you think you may have heard of this case before, that may be why. But he obviously wasn't missing for as long as Michelle And his reasons for leaving, I feel like, are very clear. He was in financial ruin. I highly doubt he ever planned to kill himself. I think he knew he would try and go and live in Mexico, and maybe he came back either because he got cocky and thought he could collect the payments,
yeah,
or he just thought people weren't looking for him.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was kind of just like the sob story of like he was trying to kill himself. This woman saved him, and then his best friend was this old dying woman that lived in Mexico, and he never thought he was a thief. Just a lot of like the dramatics to kind of make him look more like a victim. Which I know it's horrible when you get too far and over your head, but like he caused a lot of damage to people.
I guess the one good part of this story is that he made sure the dog was cared for.
He did seem to like home. In leaving the girl the paycheck. Like,
yeah,
he did leave some things.
And gave his girlfriend the jogging suit and the shoes.
Yeah, the expensive boots.
I haven't seen anything about his family. Like, obviously, they probably prefer to remain low-key, like his 8 children and his ex-wife. But I just can't even imagine, too, that being your dad. It seems like, from what I can gather, is he left the family in D.C., he moved to Colorado.
Yeah, it seems like he wasn't in their daily life.
No, absolutely. He doesn't, not a stand-up guy, really.
Yeah, so that is it. I guess there's not really much to discuss since we have all the answers for him, but love to know what everyone thinks about these stories together in general.
Yeah, I'll say this. I feel like in Michelle's case especially, there is a lot of anger in regards to her having the opportunity to have come forward, and she chose not to, despite her knowing about her child's cancer and all that type of stuff, probably knowing, whereas, I'm guessing she knew. So I feel like there is the general feeling in regards to Michelle is one of anger and, I guess, disbelief about how anyone could do that to their family, but we don't know what went on behind closed doors. Maybe we will find out in the next few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope we find out more, but I have a feeling we won't. But we'll see.
I don't know. I feel like Michelle, maybe if she does get offered money to tell her story, she might tell. I don't know.
So someone out there offer money, because I want to know. But then I don't maybe want Brian her to have the money.
Brian might be on the case. That might be his next big one after Nancy.
Yeah. All right. So that is it for this episode. Everything will be on the blog at truecrimesocietyblog.com. Make sure you're following us on Instagram at True Crime Society. We're always posting the latest updates there, especially if you're following the Nancy case. Not that there's many updates. Maybe it'll be solved by this point. Who knows? Probably not. Yeah. If you want to follow us on Instagram, mine is stephsum_olivia's tcsolivia. Make sure you check us out on Patreon as well. We do all the episodes without ads. We do weekly bonus episodes. Plus, there's just some fun chats and stuff on there. And you'll get a shout out in the main episode, which is pretty cool. So check us out over there. All the usual stuff. You could just comment, subscribe, follow, reshare to your Instagram stories. That's a big help to us. We like to see what you guys are doing while you listen to the podcast. We love resharing them as well. So keep doing that. And that is it. So thank you guys for listening. Stay safe out there. Peace out.
See ya.